Hello, and thank you for being with us today. I hope you've had a great and fruitful week. We've been talking about ways to learn new skills, so we can best approach the mind training teachings in the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by Namkar Pal. Our discussion came out of one of the instructions in the text, train first in the easiest practices. And according to Namkar Pal, this means we should only practice on a mental level at first and not try to push beyond our limits. When we are convinced enough in our mind, we can start building on small practical steps until we are familiar enough to be comfortable in doing a practice wholeheartedly. We looked at how some Western experiments back up this type of approach, and last time visited an article by Thorin Klausowski on the changes in the brain when we learn something new and the best ways to make those changes. We saw that what he called long-term potentiation occurs when we stimulate two neurons. This essentially means the link between them becomes stronger and the activity we're practicing becomes easier. We also talked about setting oneself up for failure as a way to learn. That is, trying something new without any assistance or instruction. This is effective because even though we may not initially succeed, we learn about how not to fail in future endeavors. Klausowski also recommended that we spread learning over time, which he called distributed practice, and not try to cram, or as he puts it, binge learn, which is less effective. We can, for instance, go for deliberate practice, which is tracking what you learn over short learning sessions. He says, instead of sitting down for hours on end to learn a skill, distributed practice is all about shorter, smaller sessions where you're stimulating the link between the neurons more often throughout time. So instead of trying to learn a skill by taking an hour-long class every night, give yourself a lot of time overall and small chunks throughout the day. It is also effective to put what we have learned into the context of our day-to-day life. Klausowski says, for example, if you're learning about mathematics, make sure you find a way to work that into your daily life, even if it's as simple as figuring out your gas mileage every day. It's simple, but it's about forming connections in your brain that actually matter to you. Now, of course, we're not much interested in learning about additions and subtractions, but it makes sense that if we want to learn to be more compassionate, we find ways to deal more compassionately with other beings in our everyday situations. That is, in addition to our readings and meditations on compassion. Then Klausowski points out that the time we practice is just as important as how we practice. The body's internal clock is tuned to work better during certain points in the day, and that goes for learning as well, he says. And then he says it's also important to apply what we learn every day. He says, the more you can apply what you're learning to your every day, the more it'll stick in your head. The reason is simple. When you're learning by doing, you're implementing everything that makes our memory work. When you're able to connect what you're learning with a real-world task, that forms the bonds in your brain, and subsequently the skills you're learning will stick around. Now, all this advice is in line with what the Tibetan masters tell us about changing our mindset. Meditate in short sessions. Apply your meditations to real-life situations. And allow your meditation practices to enhance your everyday life. Be at ease with failure, especially in the beginning, but try your best to learn from it. In these ways, we can carry our mental practices into our practical lives, making those practices come alive and beneficial. So now, that is enough on train the first and the easiest practices. Let's go on to the next slogan. But before that, we have to think about motivation as we usually do. And as usual, let it be a bodhicitta motivation. May this program be a cause for our enlightenment so we can be of the greatest benefit to all living beings. Please take a moment to think about your motivation and make it vastly beneficial like that, if you find your mind is fixed on something small and self-interested. Thank you. Our next slogan is a rather enigmatic one. Whichever occurs, be patient with both. What do you think that means? Whatever occurs, be patient with both. Namkar Pal says this: whether happiness or suffering befalls the body and mind, as was explained in the context of transforming adverse conditions into the path, you should transform it into a factor conducive to accomplishing enlightenment. Which is not quite as cryptic as the slogan, but this probably also needs more explanation. So let's take a look at how Pema Chodron explains it. In her book, Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living, she has a chapter titled The Big Squeeze, and she discusses the slogan as part of that. The whole chapter is such a great teaching on where we find ourselves that I think we should not only pick out the paragraphs on the slogan, but start from the beginning of the chapter. And this is what she writes. If we want to communicate and we have a strong aspiration to help others, on the level of social action, on the level of our family, at work in our community, or we just want to be there for the people when they need us, then sooner or later we're going to experience the big squeeze. Our ideals and the reality of what's really happening don't match. We feel as if we're between the fingers of a big giant who is squeezing us. We find ourselves between a rock and a hard place. There's often a discrepancy between our ideals and what we actually encounter. For instance, with raising children, we have a lot of good ideas, but sometimes it's very challenging to put together all the good ideas with the way our children really are. They're at the breakfast table with food all over themselves. Or with meditation. Have you noticed how difficult it is to actually feel emotions without getting totally swept away by them? Or how difficult it is simply to cultivate friendliness towards yourself when you're feeling completely miserable or panicked or caught up? There's a discrepancy between your inspiration and the situation as it presents itself, the immediacy of the situation. It's the rub between those two things, the squeeze between reality and vision, that causes you to grow up, to wake up, to be 100% decent, alive, and compassionate. The big squeeze is one of the most productive places on the spiritual path, and in particular in this journey of awakening the heart. It's worth talking about because when we find ourselves in that place again and again, usually we want to run away. Sometimes we want to give up the whole thing. It's like burnout. It feels extremely uncomfortable and you can't wiggle out of it. It's like a dog that gets its teeth in your arm and you just can't shake it off. Times of the big squeeze feel like crisis periods. We have the aspiration to wake up and to help. At the same time, it doesn't seem to work out on our terms. It feels impossible for us to buy our situation and also impossible to throw it out. Being caught in a big squeeze humbles you, and at the same time, it has great vision. And this is the interesting part. It softens you, and yet it has a big perspective. Through meditation practice, we learn not to reject, but also not to grasp. This is the same paradox that we presented with in our lives. It's not so much that you do or you don't reject. It's more that sometimes you find that you can't do either, or that you do both at the same time. Pema Chodron then uses an example from her own life in which she was invited to teach by Sawan, the eldest son of her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa. It put her in a dilemma. She writes, "Sometimes I was treated as a big deal who should come in through a special door and sit in a special seat. Then I'd think, okay, I'm a big deal. I'd start running with that idea and come up with a big deal notions about how things should be. And then I'd get the message back, oh, no, 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 you should just sit on the floor and mix with everybody and be one of the crowd. Okay, so now the message was that I should be just ordinary, not set myself up or be the teacher. But as soon as I was getting comfortable with being humble, I would be asked to do some special thing or the other that only big deals did. This was a painful experience because I was always being insulted and humiliated by my own expectations. As soon as I was sure how it should be, so I could feel secure, I would get a message that it should be the other way. And finally, I said to Sawang, this is really hurting. I just don't know who I'm supposed to be. And he said, well, you have to learn to be big and small at the same time. I think that's the point, says Pema Chodron. We can always get comfortable being either big or small, either right or wrong. Although we think that wrong is bad, if we get into the habit of thinking that we are wrong, that can be quite comfortable too. Any ground will do. We just want to be able to get our ground, either as a loser or as a winner, as a big deal or an ordinary deal. But if we wish to communicate, if we really wish to open our hearts, sooner or later we're going to find ourselves in the big squeeze, where we can't buy it and we can't throw it out. And we are caught in the juicy situation of being big and small at the same time. Life is glorious, but life is also wretched. Appreciating the gloriousness inspires us, encourages us, cheers us up, gives us a bigger perspective and energizes us. We feel connected. But if that's all that's happening, we get arrogant and start to look down on others. We make ourselves a big deal and want life to be like that forever. The gloriousness becomes tinged by craving and addiction. On the other hand, wretchedness, life's painful aspect, softens us up considerably. Knowing pain is an important ingredient of being there for another person. When you're feeling grief, you can look right into somebody's eyes because you feel you haven't got anything to lose. You're just there. The wretchedness humbles us and softens us. But if we're only wretched, we would all be so depressed and hopeless that we wouldn't have enough energy to eat an apple. Gloriousness and wretchedness need each other. One inspires us, the other softens us. They go together. Today, he says, are instructions on how to communicate from the heart. The emphasis is on how to keep one's heart open for the juiciness and richness of the big squeeze. One of the slogans is, whichever of the two occurs, be patient. Whether it is glorious or wretched, delightful or hateful, be patient. Patience allows things to unfold at their own speed, rather than jumping in with your habitual response to either pain or pleasure. The real happiness that underlies both gloriousness and wretchedness often gets short-circuited by our jumping too fast into the same habitual pattern. Patience is not learned in safety. It is not learned when everything is harmonious and going well. When everything is smooth sailing, who needs patience? If you stay in your room with the door locked and the curtains drawn, everything may seem harmonious. But the minute anything doesn't go your way, you blow up. There is no cultivation of patience when your pattern is to just try to seek harmony and smooth everything out. Patience implies willingness to be alive rather than trying to seek harmony. A hermit, well known for his austerity, had been practicing in a cave for 20 years. An unconventional teacher named Patril Rumshe showed up at the cave, and the hermit humbly and sweetly welcomed him in. Patril Rumshe said, "Tell me, what have you been doing here?" "I've been practicing the perfection of patience," the hermit answered. Putting his face very close to the hermit's face, Patril Rumshe said, "But a pair of old scoundrels like us, we don't care anything about patience, really. We only do this to get everyone's admiration, right? We just do this to get people to think we're big shots, don't we?" And the hermit started getting irritated. But Patril Rumshe wouldn't stop. He just kept laughing and patting him on the back and saying, "Yeah, we sure know how to dupe people, don't we? We really know. I'll bet they bring you lots of gifts, don't they?" At this point, the hermit stood up and screamed, "Why did you come here? Why are you tormenting me? Go away and leave me in peace." And then the Rinpoche said, "So now, where is your perfection of patience?" So that's the point, Pema Chodron says. We can create the ideal situation in which we have a very high opinion of ourselves. But how do we do when it comes to the big squeeze? Now, isn't it interesting that the mind training teachings recommend patience for both good circumstances and bad? Normally, we look for the good and fight the bad, and that is where we find impatience. As Pema Chodron says, Why would we practice patience when things are going well? It is what we want, so there appears to be no need for patience then. However, of course, the catch is that good circumstances don't last. We'd be fine if once in a good situation we could stay there forever. Then what would be the need of patience? But that's not how it works, is it? We know that good circumstances will sooner or later inevitably dissolve into uncomfortable ones. And so our attitude to the good times must take that into account. It's so easy to get stuck in the idea that my good fortune is endless, so I can be careless. But it often takes very little to turn good fortune into bad. Buddhism recommends we take everything in our stride, not being too happy with the good or unhappy with the bad, because both will change. It's inevitable. That's why we need this attitude of patience with both good and bad. Now, you probably know the Taoist story of the old farmer whose horse ran away. It appears on many websites, but I'm going to take it from medium.com, which includes it in the transcript of a TEDx talk given by David Allen, who writes for the Wisdom Project for CNN. Allen illustrates it beautifully with occurrences from his own life. He says nobody knows the origin of the story, but it comes from Taoism, and it could be over 2,000 years old. But it's still relevant to our lives, and very much so in the light of our slogan. This is how David Allen tells it. It's a story of a farmer and his horse. One day, his horse runs away, and his neighbor comes over and says to commiserate, "I'm so sorry about your horse." And the farmer says, "Who knows what's good or bad?" The neighbor is confused because this is clearly terrible. The horse is the most valuable thing he owns. But the horse comes back the next day and brings with him 12 feral horses. The neighbor comes back over to celebrate. "Congratulations on your great fortune." But the farmer replies again, "Who knows what's good or bad?" And the next day, the farmer's son is taming one of the wild horses when he's thrown and breaks his leg. The neighbor comes back over, "Oh, I'm so sorry about your son." The farmer repeats, "Who knows what's good or bad?" Sure enough, the next day the army comes through their village and is conscripting able-bodied young men to go and fight in a war. But the son is spared because of his broken leg. And that is where Allen ends his list, though more commonly the neighbor comes by saying, "How wonderful your son was spared." To which the farmer replies, "Yes, you've guessed it. Who knows what's good or bad?" Allen, however, has this to say. And this story can go on and on like that. Good, bad, who knows? But what's the point? Well, the meaning of that story, he says, is that the Western paradigm in which we label experiences good or bad is wrong. It's a false dichotomy. At the very least, this distinction between good and bad is not so clear. It's blurry. The Taoists have another way to symbolize who knows what's good or bad, and it's in that old hippie chestnut, the yin and yang symbol. We see black and white, right and wrong, good and bad, but it's fluid. One is melting into the other, even contained inside the other. These things aren't contradictory, they're complementary. They're two parts of a greater whole. There is just what is, and it's good and bad. He goes on to say that he's not trying to give a neither good nor bad answer to the really awful stuff that happens, like Hitler, the American school shootings, global warming and so on. He's just arguing for it as if personal philosophy, which is what we Buddhists are doing too, aren't we? Though from a Buddhist point of view, world occurrences arise out of the karma groups of individuals create. But anyway, he goes on to give real life examples. A climber who invented prosthetics that made him a better climber after he lost both his legs. The terrorist's son who became a peace activist because of his father. Luke Skywalker, whose family's deaths allowed him to go off to win Star Wars. The idea that challenges helps us grow, that we develop as a result of the hard things that happen to us, is the classic hero's journey, he says. Pain can give us focus. Defeat can create empathy. the idea that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, these are all contained in the idea that we can get good out of the seemingly bad. But the inverse is true too. You can find potentially bad in what seems good. My favorite example of this are lottery winners. Lottery winners are shockingly unhappy not long after their greatest wish comes true. Think how often you've heard the phrase, "Be careful what you wish for." That's who knows what's good or bad. Having a clear head, even when things are up, and looking for the hidden downsides is key. I'm thinking of the housing bubble, the dot-com boom, the roaring 20s. Having a greater perspective will help you make better decisions. Beyond the fact that good can come from bad and bad can come from good, this story has a deeper meaning. And the deeper meaning is that once you move past good and bad, you become less concerned about outcome. You become more accepting to how things evolve naturally. And then he goes on to show how the neighbor's mindset mirrors most of ours. It's like we're on a roller coaster, which can be fun, but only for very short periods. It's not that the farmer is unengaged in life, says Alan. It's not that he's unable to be happy or sad, but he has a greater perspective. He sees the bigger picture. He knows that he can't stop things from happening, but he can control how he reacts to them. And it's often not the experience that matters as what you do with that experience. Which brings me back to the first time I read the story of the horse and the farmer. I read it in a book by Huston Smith, the comparative religion scholar, and the book was called The Religions of Man. I read it while I was a philosophy major here at Maryland, which meant I was reading a lot of textbooks, and I was reading Huston Smith for fun. But despite all these pages that I was reading, somehow the 7.5 lines of this story stood out for me. I just kept thinking about them over and over again, not for any particular reason. I just liked the story. And not long after reading it, the story made the surprising leap from the theoretical to the real. I was a White House intern, and one morning I used to commute from campus to downtown, 45 minutes to an hour each way. I got down to the old executive office building and realized that I'd forgotten my security ID and they would not let me in. They said I had to go all the way back to my dorm to get it. And I was on the metro and I was annoyed at myself for forgetting it. I was annoyed at the security policy. I was anxious that I was going to be 2 hours late to work. While I was on the metro, a delivery man came on and he was pushing a dolly sky high with boxes. Every movement of the train threatened to knock this tower down. And then, as the metro does, it just stopped out of nowhere, and this tower of boxes was about to fall on a little old lady who was sitting right next to him. And I jumped up and caught the boxes with my body and my hands. The delivery man and the old lady were effusively thanking me, and I just modestly said, "I'm just glad I was there to help." Who knows what's good or bad? And then I started thinking of what I could apply, who knows what's good or bad, to. Everything, if you think about it. Mostly the small stuff, like that thing where you forgot your keys, and you can go back to get them and realize the other thing you forgot that's even more important than the keys. But the big stuff too. When I lived in San Francisco, I applied for a high-profile job that I really wanted. And when I didn't get it, I was devastated. I definitely did not see the good that came out of not getting that job. And then I got another job, and I liked that job plenty. But my girlfriend got an opportunity to work overseas, and I followed her, and I was able to keep the job I had and telecommute from Bangkok, Thailand. I would not have been able to do that if I'd gotten the first job, and I'm now married to that girlfriend. Years later, we were living in New York, and my wife worked for a magazine, and she got a big promotion and she got a big raise. Now that's good, right? Except, less than a year later, when the magazine was making budget cuts, she was the first one laid off because of that raise. Now that's bad, right? Except that if you ask my wife now, she'll tell that's the best thing that ever happened to her in her career. She now writes magazine articles, she wrote a book, She's an editorial director for a non-profit, and she spends more time with our family. I told my sister the story of the horse and the farmer, and she incorporated it into her work. She's a social worker in Phoenix, Arizona, and she told the story to her clients. These are folks dealing with serious issues: homelessness, addiction, chronic unemployment. They have incorporated who knows what's good or bad into their sessions. They now use it as shorthand to give context to their struggles, and it helps them work it out emotionally. He goes on to say that he found the story of the farmer again 20 years after reading it for the first time. It was in a book titled Zen Shorts by John Muth, and by that time he could read it to his daughters. As I read them the story over and over and over again, as you do with young kids, I kept thinking I could have used this story when I was young. I wish I'd known about who knows what's good or bad when I was 8, 12, 16. But then I thought, who knows what's good or bad works retroactively. Although his parents got divorced when he was 2 and he was brought up by a single working mum, his experience led to many of the things he values: his confidence, independence, political views, even how he raised his daughters. He says that when you're truly happy, look back and you will see the seeds of the happiness in the bad things that happened. Is it possible that every bad thing is really good if you just wait long enough? He asks. Who knows? I do know 3 things. I know that it's important to find a deeper meaning in the good and bad things that happen in our lives. Look for the bad inside the good. Look for the good inside the bad. It will let you see the bigger picture, and you will make better decisions. Second, if you can pull down the framing device of good and bad, on the other side you will have a deeper understanding of how the world works. You will be calmer in the face of stress, and you will be more willing to take risks. Third, philosophy is not theoretical, it's practical. This story speaks to me, and it helps me, and maybe this story speaks to you too. But if not, find your story. Don't let good ideas just be in the pages of a textbook. Let ideas guide you. And if you do these things, I don't promise that everything is going to be good, because there's no such thing, but it will make you wiser. That is David Allen on Who Knows What Is Good or Bad. And that is where we're going to have to leave the program today, as our time is up. I hope it's been of some benefit, and thanks for being with us, and please dedicate the positive potential to gaining enlightenment for all living beings. And now, as the Xhosa say, Humbugashli, go safely.